make contact with your host, Brendan Cook.
Start off with a little news story about MySpace.com, and I know a lot of you out there know what this is. A lot of you probably have a MySpace account. We have a MySpace account, so you know, it's a pretty big thing right now. A lot of people are using it, and a lot of people are networking with it, and a lot of people seem to like it. But earlier this week, there was, I guess you would call it a news story, maybe not so much a news story as an article from Infowars.com, PrisonPlanet.com, and TheJonesReport.com. I think those are all the ones that he runs. He came up with a... I don't know if it's a theory or what about the buyout of MySpace. And this is something, for those of you who don't know, in July 2005, Rupert Murdoch, and I'm sure a lot of you know that name, that is the guy that owns Fox, News Corp, you know, big media mogul guy, actually bought out MySpace. And, you kind of have to think, why would he have done that? What was he thinking? And this kind of goes along the lines with what he said last week. Last week, he did a press conference and said, hey, you know what? And this was to all his media people, you know, Fox News, all the other ones that he runs. He basically told them, you know what? Our medium is dying. We can't control it anymore. We're losing out to the internet. The internet is the next news source. And I think a lot of us have known this for years. I can't count the last time I actually got my main news from a newspaper. I read it online, just like, you know, probably 70% of the people do. What I'd like to do is kind of, you know, read this story and you know, find out what you guys think. You know, be sure to email us and let us know. Post on the message boards what you think about this, I guess, theory. Could this happen? I know I've talked to my producer, Jamie, who is just an insane whiz at the internet. It seems like he knows pretty much everything out there to know about the internet. And, you know, he's pretty much told me that what Alex Jones is suggesting in this article can't really happen. There's no way to really regulate it like, you know, Alex Jones is making you think they can. By all means, we really do want to see if we can get a guest on this, somebody to come out and talk about this, and Alex Jones would be great to have on. I don't see it happening anytime soon, but I would love to have him on to talk about it. What I'm going to do is I'm going to read this story and see what you guys think about it. Hopefully, like I said, we'll have somebody come on and talk about it. All right, this is quoting TheJonesReport.com now. As the eighth most popular destination on the internet, MySpace.com represents socialization and free speech online. Its entire appeal revolves around the venue it affords for personal expression and networking. From its inception, it was a trendy virtual meeting space for a youth-oriented audience that promotes bands, filmmakers, and other media. However, since the acquisition of MySpace in July 2005 by media mogul Rupert Murdoch, MySpace has altered its terms of service and privacy policy. It now reserves the right to edit content or remove profiles with or without notice. This raises concerns for freedom of speech online as establishment business interests clearly seek to limit critical expression. There will be much more of this to come under Internet 2. What is now a business's discriminatory right will feel like communist China's censorship when the Internet becomes increasingly unreliable and undesirable. Users will be pushed towards the state-regulated hub where permission will need to be obtained directly from an FCC or government bureau to set up a website. Already, businesses and organizations without massive advertising budgets will face de facto restrictions of distribution. And then this next part of the story gets into something that I've been paying attention to a lot for the last couple of weeks. AOL came out and said that they were going to do this. they've been facing a lot of heat for it, like they weren't already before this. I mean, this was just something they didn't need to do, and it blows me away why they even did it. But they did it, and it looks like Yahoo is going to follow suit, and I think Yahoo will kind of wait and see how AOL handles it, and from there, they'll decide if they're going to do it or not. Back to quoting the story. America Online and Yahoo, two of the world's largest providers of email accounts, are about to start using a system that gives preferential treatment to messages from companies that pay from a quarter of a cent to a penny each to have them delivered. The senders must promise to contact only people who have agreed to receive their messages or risk being blocked entirely. This is reported in a New York Times article last week. Blogging sites have complained about MySpace's censorship and removal of outsider links to video embedders such as YouTube, as well as the use of computer spiders to delete objectionable keywords. The greater fear is that MySpace.com and others are editing or deleting user accounts based upon politically controversial content. One MySpace.com user complained that her profile, 911 Truth, was removed completely because one of the pictures did not comply with terms of service. Now, Rupert Murdoch, 2 weeks ago, came out and held a press conference with the media groups that he controls, and in this, he basically stated that the media is losing its ground to new technology and communication. Now, think about that. What does that mean? I mean, is he saying that we need to destroy these technologies, or we need to kind of become these technologies? We need to be the ones creating the technology. If that's the case, then what he's been saying before this, and basically what this whole article is saying, is that is what they want to do. The mainstream media wants to take over the internet. Businesses want to take over the internet. Governments want to take over the internet. And the whole question about this, is it possible? Can this be done? And like I said, I've talked to my producer, Jamie, who is just so amazing at the internet and knows, it seems like, everything. I mean, this guy can probably name off IP ranges in a matter of seconds and not even sweat about it. He has basically told me that this is not possible. He doesn't see how this could happen. But where the government and these businesses would have all this money, could they actually do it? You know, I'm reading this just to let you guys know and see what you think about it. I mean, definitely send us messages and let us know what you think is going on. Do you think this is possible? And in the end, is this just some kind of paranoid conspiracy theory? Did Rupert Murdoch just see a chance to make money with this thing that was becoming a large gathering place, you know, for him to put all his ads on and things like that? All right, so we've got that out of the way, and the next thing I'm going to talk about, and this is definitely something we're looking at doing future shows on, and I say shows because I don't want to do just one. I would like to do a lot of shows about this because I think for me, and not just me, but so many other people, this is an amazing subject, and I'm talking about urban legends. Urban legends are just, to me, the most amazing thing out there. They're so fun to listen to, and I think I'm really intrigued by not just the legend itself, but how it starts and how it gets passed around and how the names kind of change and events change, but the whole moral of the story stays the same. And the other part of urban legends that's so amazing is that they do have morals. I mean, pretty much all the urban legends you hear have some kind of moral behind them about, you know, teenage sex and things like that, things you shouldn't be doing, but you do them anyway, and somebody pays the consequence in the legend. So, of course, you hear it, and you go, well, no, I'm not going to do that again. Look what happened to that person. This kind of goes to my point. We're going to try and get somebody from Snopes.com to come on the show and, you know, talk about all the urban legends. And for those of you who don't know what Snopes is this amazing, amazing website that's devoted strictly to urban legends. I don't think there's an urban legend I've heard of that I haven't found on Snopes, and all the different variations, how they started, when they first appeared. It tells you if they are true or not, if there's some sort of truth to them, and, you know, they're partly true, partly not true, things like that. And, I mean, it's this amazing database of all these urban legends you've heard over the years. And the other thing that's so amazing to me about this website is they're not just, I mean, you've heard Bloody Mary and you've heard of, you know, you drive into a cemetery and flash your light three times at the top of the hill and some woman walks in front of your car. I mean, we've all heard the different variations of these stories. But there are so many stories out there that you'd be surprised that they were urban legends. You've heard them from your coworkers, your mom, your dad, things like that, and they're not so outlandish. The end always kind of seems outlandish, but then you kind of rationalize it and say, well, that makes sense, that could have happened. But then you go to the site and you see the exact same story and you go, wow, hold on a second, that was an urban legend? You know, this thing that you've believed all these years that really happened, you go, wow, that really never happened. I can't believe that. I'll be honest, one of the other great things about Snopes, and that's S-N-O-P, P as in Paul, E-S.com, is you hear these stories, and you'll be surprised. You'll notice it, too. After you go to Snopes.com, and you go through quite a few of the different legends, you know, and they break them down in categories like auto, horrors, candy, kids, movie stars, things like that. Go through a lot of these, and you will be surprised the next time you go to work or you're out talking to a bunch of people, how many times these legends come up. And had you not gone to Snopes, you would have no idea. You would have bought it. You would have said, oh, wow, God, that's amazing. But you'll read so many of these legends, and you'll be able to spot them the second somebody starts talking, and they almost show you how to spot them as far as the way people start to deliver them. And it's almost within the first four or five words you know it's going to be an urban legend. It's kind of a fun thing to do, to be the one in the room going, hey, I know about that. You know, if you really want to be mean, you can actually finish the story for them. They'll hate you if you do that. And I think that's what I love about that site. So that's another thing we're definitely going to work on getting on the show, is somebody from Snopes.com to kind of go over these urban legends and how they do get started and why they seem to last so long. What brought me into this is I have a file I'm going to play that, and this goes back to what I was saying, that these things that you've heard that you took as truth for so long, and then all of a sudden you find out, God, that wasn't true. And this file that I'm going to play is something I heard when I first got the internet. So this would have been 95, I believe, so sometime about 95. And basically, it's this radio DJ reading a fax that somebody sent him, and the fax was supposed to be an article from the LA Times. And for the longest time, this was believed as truth. And especially in Utah, which is where I broadcast from, This was looked at as just insane because this supposedly took place in Utah. And it is one of the most hilarious clips I think I have ever heard. And for years after I heard this, I went around telling people, oh my God, you know, you've got to hear this. You'll never believe what happened in Salt Lake. And to go to Snopes and see this legend on there and then see the audio file and read that it wasn't true and why it kind of started, it just blew me away. But, you know, I'm going to play this audio file because I think you guys are going to laugh so hard. It is one of the most hilarious things I have ever heard in my life. And I should mention this now. If for whatever reason kids are listening to this show, which I don't see that happening, but if they are, I don't know if I'd let them listen to this clip. I'll put it this way. If I had a kid, I would not have him or her listen to this clip. It does have some adult themes, and, you know, I think most of us here are adults. We can handle it. We're going to think it's funny. But there's some that, you know, may not like it. So, I mean, if you're easily offended by adult situations, I wouldn't listen to it. Other than that, enjoy the clip, and I'll be right back with you.
Here's a fax from Cooter in Orlando, who sends me a copy of a story that appeared in the Los Angeles Times. He says, a prestigious newspaper, not the oft-maligned Weekly World News. Quoting the story, in retrospect, lighting the match was my big mistake, but I was only trying to retrieve the gerbil. Eric Tomaszewski told bemused doctors in the severe burns unit of Salt Lake City Hospital. Tomaszewski and his homosexual partner, Andrew Kinky Farnham, had been admitted for emergency treatment after a felching session had gone seriously wrong. I pushed a cardboard tube up his rectum and slipped Raggett, our gerbil, in, he explained. As usual, Tiki shouted out, Armageddon! My cue, he'd had enough. I tried to retrieve Raggett, but he wouldn't come out again, so I peered into the tube and struck a match, thinking the light might attract him. At a hushed press conference, a hospital spokesman described what happened next. The match ignited a pocket of intestinal gas and flame shot out the tube, igniting Mr. Tomaszewski's hair and severely burning his face. It also set fire to the gerbil's fur and whiskers, which in turn ignited a larger pocket of gas further up the intestine, propelling the rodent out like a cannonball. Armageddon! Armageddon! Thomas. Tomaszewski suffered second-degree burns and a broken nose from the impact of the gerbil, while Furnham suffered first and second-degree burns to his anus and lower intestinal tract. Time again! peered into the tube and struck a match, thinking the light might make the gerbil come out. Armageddon!
It's so stupid. I cannot believe I actually bought that. That it blows me away. I mean, I am talking for years. 7, 8, 9, 10 years. I know that happened. I know for a fact it happened. I heard it on the radio. And now I just feel so stupid. You know, if you guys want to hear that clip again, you can go to our website and download the podcast. Go straight to the clip. You can also go to Snopes.com. That's S-N-O-P, as in Paul, E-S.com, and I believe you can type in Richard Gere and get that clip. I don't need to tell you why. So that's it. That's the first part of the show, and we're going to come right back. I believe Barbara Macbeth will actually be here, and I do believe Roger will be with her. So that should be fun. We'll be talking about the latest stuff the GIS has been doing, what they're planning on doing. I guess I should say what we're planning on doing. And, you know, we're going to be talking about things that we haven't really done before. I know a lot of you have heard us on Coast to Coast AM, and we really only get into EVP and things like that. So we're kind of going to go deeper into, you know, what got Barbara into this? Why does she like doing it? We've never really covered that before, so, and it's just such a fascinating story to hear it from her. And the way she tells it, I mean, Barbara is just such a wonderful woman. She's so fun to listen to, and she's so fun to be around, and Roger is so fun to be around. I mean, they're both just such amazing people. I am so happy every day I get to work with them and do this thing called the GIS. So, in a minute, they will be coming up.
Listening to Contact Beyond, broadcast live every Thursday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Central.
Contact Beyond is not responsible for fatigue, questioning reality, thinking for yourself, or sudden feelings of enlightenment.
And welcome back to Contact Beyond. I am your host, Brendan Cook, and I am here with two people who really don't need an introduction, but I'm going to give it to them anyway. It's Barbara McBeth and Roger McBeth.
Hello.
Howdy.
You're right up to the mic there, boy.
Hello.
So, kids are from the GIS. I hear that's a pretty good group.
I like it.
Outstanding.
Tell me about it. What's going on?
Well, it's kind of difficult to tell you, Brendan, because...
You're out there with
just me. Pretend you don't know who I am.
The GIS is a group of five members. Three members are in this room. The other two are working right now. And we go to locations that are reportedly haunted or have some kind of ghost activity, and we go there and record and take pictures and videotape and talk with the property owners or the people living there and take it from there.
I'm going to do something to you that I think it's only fitting, because I know we've done these interviews before, and it's so odd to sit there and be on the opposite end of stuff. And you know, I compare it to, like, you're actually holding the gun as opposed to having the gun fired at you. So, I hear you do a lot with this EVP stuff. What is that? I mean, just kind of explain to us what EVP is.
Now, Brendan, that's a cruel thing to do. Well, it stands for electronic voice phenomena, and it is a process where voices are recorded that you do not hear at the time of the recording. Sometimes you hear them, but the majority of times you don't hear the voice, and there is a voice that gets recorded. Sometimes it's responding to what is being said at the time of the recording. Other times it's like it's somebody talking to someone else that's not there that you can't see. Sometimes it gives contemporary information that we weren't aware of at the time. What I really enjoy about it is that it gives, when it takes place, usually you can tell that it is an EVP just because of how the words are pronounced, and the sound of the quality of the voice is so different. There have been times when we've recorded voice an EVP that has been just as clear and louder than us at the time of the recording, but the whole aspect of it is quite interesting.
This is weird, talking to you across the room.
Yeah, believe me, I know. It's definitely different.
Yeah, and there's lights. There's no headstones. There's lights. I can see you. My word, you've gotten big.
Yeah. Oh, good God. Thank you.
No, I mean, like growing up, not wise.
Oh, growing up wise, not wide wise. Yeah. Is that what that is? All right. So, I mean, we've gone over the EVP thing. What is it you use to record EVP? And I know where this is going to go, so I've already got this planned out. So hopefully you answer my question right, and I don't have to go over this with you, Barbara.
Well, I like to use a
and here's
micro
the key.
Cassette.
Wait. Here is the key word. I like to use, what was it?
The microcassette recorder.
But you also have
a digital recorder.
The yes. D word.
But it is not as convenient to use as a tape recorder. And I really am from the old school, I guess, which I really like the convenience of a tape recorder. Because you can fill up a tape, slap another one in there, just keep recording. And with the digital, there's so many complications with it. I just don't...
You know what else you can do with the digital?
I like the quality of the digital. I must say that is... I mean, that is nice.
Yes,
but
they
should make tape or digital recorders that last like 3 or 4 hours and you don't run out of memory.
But they do. They make digital recorders that last for days.
Where?
They're expensive, and I don't see us getting any, but they do.
They do?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, you have to keep in mind, babe, you can't even program a VCR.
Well, what's that? Well, I know. I'm from
you. You got to keep in mind that you have a VCR.
Yes, and I use it.
Yeah, and I've got to say this to the people at home, you know. Barbara and Roger came over, and I'm showing him my TiVo. And Barbara's just looking at me like, oh, my God, how does that work?
What will they think of next?
I showed her about the 30 episodes of The Twilight Zone I have programmed, and she's like, oh, wow.
This is bizarre.
What's that?
Sitting here talking to you when I'm used to being out in the dark.
Oh, you want it to be dark in here. I can shut off the lights.
No,
man.
No. It's just different for me sitting here. We're not out going, oh, is anybody around?
Oh, it's not just different for you. I think it's different for everybody in this room. This whole thing is completely different. We talked about the EVP and all that. So what I do want to talk about now is just recently, within the last 4 months, you guys were involved with something called the X-Testers. Now, what was that about?
I'm really not sure what it was about.
You and a lot of other people, Barbara.
How I understand it is there was special effects guys were involved in it.
And who were these special effects guys? Did you know any of them? Did they?
No. I'd never met them before, if that's what you mean.
No. But, I mean, did you know who they were? I know there's one guy that you know who it was.
Well, there was one guy that was the son of an actor that played Gilligan that I never watched. I've never seen one's episode.
He sure looks like his dad.
I didn't think he looked anything like him, but...
But you never watched the episode,
but
so
I never
how do
watched
you know?
The episode, but I did see...
I mean, your impression of Gilligan and mine may be completely different, Barbara.
Oh, I'm sure it's very different.
Oh, okay.
But I don't watch too much television, it's, you know.
But you sure like the TiVo.
Oh, I thought T-bone. I thought it was TiVo.
No, it's TiVo.
Steve-O?
No, good God. TiVo!
But the thing I didn't like about it was they were deceptive with us.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I didn't... my impression before we met with them and did an investigation with them, and I was under the impression that they wouldn't be doing that kind of thing. And so it really disappointed me that when they did. The one guy had a compass that was using Roger's compass, and he had a large magnet, and which was making the compass move by itself, you know, it looked like. But he had it on his person and was doing it intentionally. And, you know, after they told us about it when they came back, they didn't let us know about it the first time.
And what I almost wonder is if they did it to kind of prove a point, because I did realize that they were kind of doing this from, you know, a skeptical eye. And I guess that would
and
be
that's
the,
fine.
Yeah, I guess that would be the case, because they are special effects people. They are trying to create this all the time. They're trying to recreate things like that. But could they have been doing it to kind of prove, because, I mean, there's been this big, huge thing lately, especially among the ghost hunting community, that these compasses are affected by other things other than, and I think, because we went into it telling them that.
Yes, that, but usually, the majority of times, we'll be walking around before we start the actual investigation, and so we test our stuff like that to see if there's any kind of a reaction, like with some of the equipment that we bring with us, see if they're, you know, we do temperature readings, if Barry's with us and has, you know, the thermal scanner, the compass, to see if anything is affecting the compass when we're walking around at the beginning, you know, if you walk through and around the building a few times that you're in or the area that you're, you know, that you're investigating and you're not getting any kind of reading or reaction with your equipment when you're walking around and you know, doing kind of just a walkthrough, and then when it does respond during a time, then you can pretty well assume that there's some other source causing this when it wasn't happening before when you were walking in that area.
What's kind of sad about the arrangement with the magnet and my compass, it's like they were trying to see our reaction if we were, I mean, it's like they played on our feelings. And we had to wait almost a month before they came out and told us the truth. the guy had this huge horseshoe bag that making my compass move around. Well, I don't move quite as regularly like if a ghost or spirit was by, because it was erratic. But at the moment I was in Barbara, we were, oh, wow.
See, when you guys told me about this, when you told me that they had done this, I mean, at first, I'll be honest, I was pissed. I mean, it pissed me off, and it should have pissed me off. It should have pissed anybody off that they did this to. And the more I thought about it, and the more I, you know, after talking to these people and seeing what they were really trying to do, what they were going out there to do, it made me wonder if they were doing it more, like you said, to test what we would do, what our reaction would be once they did it. You know, would we go and try and investigate the cause of it, or would we just go, oh, it's a ghost, and kind of go from there? I think that's what they did, and, you know, I don't know if I've asked you, did they film you as they were doing this, or was this just kind of off on the side?
I really wasn't paying attention to what they all were doing. I really don't know if they, I have a feeling that they probably
did. Yes, they had two cameras on us, but it was just sad because, we didn't lay claims to anything, but for all ghost hunters out there, when something develops, you know, there's a, wow, we have company. And they were playing off our emotions, like laughing at us.
Well, you know, I can remember making the comment to them. It says, we have tried to get the compass, you know, when we ask them, ask a ghost, you know, or spirits, anything there to, you know, come and be with us. And we've never gotten a reaction like that. And every time the guy was intentionally saying, will you come over on this side of me? And the compass would move over to that side of him. And then, I mean, who would have thought the guy had a magnet and trying to do that, you know? And I said, we've tried to do that and have never gotten a response like that.
I almost wonder if they were, in a way, do you know who Josh Underwood is?
No.
Okay. He is a guy I'm actually looking at trying to get him on the show, but he is a guy that, especially lately, he's also a magician. He basically goes out and tries to, I guess what these people were doing, recreate things, but doing it like how a magician would do it. Mm-hmm. And he has actually gone out and went with ghost groups and done pretty much the same thing that these people did. This is actually how I found out about this. After you guys told me what this guy did, I went and started looking around and found out that this guy was doing almost the exact same thing, filming the reactions of the ghost hunters, and then just playing them back at these lectures that he does.
Mm-hmm.
I almost wonder if that's where they got the idea for this, because this guy has been doing it for years and years, and he's actually gone so far as to show what can affect a compass.
Mm-hmm.
Paint can affect a compass. Electrical currents, if, you know, for some reason it's off and then all of a sudden turns back on, in one spot where there wasn't any kind of readings, 10 minutes later when the current's actually running, there would be a reading.
Right.
Well, you know, Brandon, like some of the nights we've been in the mausoleum in the middle of the room, roof is up 25 to 30 feet above us, 15, 20 feet from the wall, we're in the middle, and my compass will react. We have pictures backing up. Hey, when we say we have company, we have pictures. I guess with all ghost hunters, and that's us too, it's just makes you feel bad when someone's out there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And see, and I don't doubt that. I mean, you know, and I know for a fact the compass thing works. I mean, I've seen it work. And I almost wonder if the only point that they were trying to prove was that maybe there was something else we could use that was a little bit more fail-safe and couldn't be affected by other things, whereas, you know, an EMF meter can actually read certain milligauss, whereas a compass, just anything that affects it is going to affect it.
That's true.
So I almost wonder if that was the point. And it's going to be interesting to see when they air this, how they present
it.
If they did film that, how they're going to present it. And, yeah. And the last thing I heard, they were going to air it. This is, I believe, TLC.
Yeah.
Is going to air it. And the last thing I heard was sometime this summer. And yours is the first.
Well, so it'll be interesting to see how they present it. You know, I mean, I just wish that they could. I think they could have done that differently.
Oh, yeah. Been straightforward with us.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And that's, like I said, that's why I wanted to know if they filmed it when they did it, or if it was just something they did on the side. And
oh, I'm sure they were filming everything.
Yeah. I remember talking to the producer over and over again. And every single time he kept telling me, because my biggest concern when they did this was that this was going to be Penn and Teller's Bullshit, which is a show, I think, on Showtime. And their whole thing is just to make people look like idiots. Anybody that deals with the paranormal...
There's a dozen shows you can name where that's what their intent is.
Oh, but this one is I mean, this goes so far as to call the people idiots and they need to be sued and things like that. I mean, that was my fear, that this is what they were going to try and do. And every time I asked the producer about this, I said, this is not how the show is going to be. And he said, absolutely not. It's not going to make you look like idiots. We're not going to film it to make you look like idiots. We're not even going to give a conclusive answer on if it was real or not. We're just going to say whether we could recreate it or not.
Anyway, it was a good experience, though. It was enjoyable to see how that works.
Well, I don't know how enjoyable it was. And I guess I wish I had stayed longer at yours, although I could see the way it was kind of going while we were there. I mean, we showed up at your filming for about an hour, and it just looked so insane. But I wish I would have seen how they did it and, you know, the end product, because, I mean, you guys have told me, but I would have liked to have seen it. I mean, I would have liked to have seen what they did. You know, Jenny, Barry, and I, and for those of you listening, this was filmed in two sets. There was, and basically the X-Testers, what they did is they concentrated on two videos that the GIS had recorded. One was The Walking Woman, which you recorded. No, wait, Sean. Sean recorded. And who is Sean?
Associate of ours that goes out once in a while.
So they were concentrating on that video. And now, where was that video recorded?
That was down at a elementary school in Magna, Utah. The school is, I think it caught on fire a year or two ago and burnt down. And we had both set up cameras at that time. I know, I think I was carrying mine, but I think somebody else, was it Jenny that had her set up?
I don't know. Honestly, I don't really, I mean, that was years ago, so I don't remember really. I mean, the point I was getting at is they concentrate on that video, and which, you know, was shot by Sean. I think I got that confused because you actually show up in the video, yeah. Which is why I think I thought you recorded it. And then they concentrated on the one that you did record, which was, what did we, Shadow Walker, I believe is what that was called?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. And the Shadow Walker one, they talked with myself, Jenny, and Barry about it. And I always thought it was weird because you're the one that recorded it, so why weren't you in it? And I believe the producer told me something about, well, you were already in the other one because you appeared in the video. They couldn't have you in this one. It was a really weird explanation. What they did, the segment that they filmed with us, you know, we went in there, and I was so ready to, and then I started thinking, well, you can't really do that because you can't be an investigator and seriously investigate things, but blindly defend something if somebody shows you a better way that it could have happened. I mean, otherwise you're defeating the whole Occam's razor purpose and all that. So we went in there, but I was ready to defend it. I said, you know, you guys are really going to have to try hard to show me that this is anything else other than what we thought it was. Because the night that you shot it, I remember looking at, well, I believe, was it the night that you shot it or the night after that you saw it? Because you didn't see it when you actually shot it.
No, I didn't see it because the camera was on a tripod. It was like the night after, I think, me and Roger were home reviewing that videotape.
And I can remember you calling me, and, I mean, it must have been 9:30 at night. I was sitting home, I was probably getting ready for bed, I don't know, and you called, you're like, oh my God, you have to see this thing that we just filmed. I mean, we must have watched that 40 times that night. You know, during that segment, and they were talking to us, interviewing us, you know, saying, well, what do you think, you know, what if they are able to duplicate it and everything? And I remember looking at the guy, and the first thing I said after he said, well, what if they can duplicate it? And I told this guy that, you know, Hollywood can really duplicate anything. I mean, they can make the Titanic look like it's floating again, but it's still at the bottom of the ocean. He didn't seem to like that too much, and I will be surprised if that actually makes it on the air.
Mm-hmm.
But we watched them do the thing. We watched them do the actual test to try and duplicate this, and some were so god-awfully funny. I mean, to look at it and go, God, that's what Hollywood thinks a ghost would look like. That doesn't even look close to the video. And then they got to this one thing, and I can remember the night that we actually tried to duplicate this. You know, it was two nights after that you had seen it. and then we went back to the school and did it. And I remember we were trying to see, well, was anybody sitting down? Was anybody walking? You know, was there a camera somewhere else? You know, anything like that. And we could never even come close to duplicating this thing. The whole point is we did try to duplicate this, because I remember seeing it and I'm like, God, I hope that's real. But I remember being skeptical. I wanted to be rational about it and say, could that have been a shadow? I mean, you know, because infrared light does cast a shadow. I mean, it's invisible unless you're looking through another infrared source. So they went and set all this stuff up, and literally the only thing that we got wrong when we tried to duplicate it was we had it backwards. What we thought, you know, I mean, in the video, it looks like somebody walking down the hallway, coming towards the camera.
Down the aisle.
Yeah, that's what it looks like. So that's what we were under the premise of duplicating it. We had somebody walking up and down the aisle, trying to cast a shadow on them, going up and down the aisle. Well, it turns out the whole thing was kind of a trick of infrared light, because the light reverts it and kind of turns it around backwards. So it wasn't somebody walking up the aisle, it was somebody walking across the aisle. And what happens is the shadow from the second camera gets picked up by the camera that actually recorded the thing and sees this person walking across the aisle, but to the camera recording it, it looks like he's walking down the aisle.
Mm-hmm.
And the second we saw, I mean, they had it duplicated to the point where it was walking in front of the same panes that you had in your video.
Right.
I mean, it disappeared in the exact same spot. It was, and, you know, it got to the point that I was almost heartbroken by it, because I'm like, God, that video was so good, but how can I fight this? I mean, it looks exactly the same. I mean,
and it's a good learning tool.
It is, and, you know, I told them that. I said, this is the most, I mean, just for you guys to be able to do this with nothing more. I mean, there was nothing else that they used other than two cameras. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
There was nobody dressed up. There was nobody anything. It was just one camera on one side and then the camera that filmed the thing. And I remember seeing that going, that's almost exactly what we did to try and duplicate it, but you just did one step different than we did. We would have come out with the exact same thing had we done it.
Right. And that's somebody crossing across the front of the aisle.
Exactly.
In the seats, going across the seats.
And
right?
I remember, oh yeah, yeah, exactly. And I mean, and it makes sense that somebody could have been sitting there, got up, and just walked across the aisle. I mean, we wouldn't have noticed because he wasn't in camera view.
Right.
And they asked us, you know, so what do you guys think about that? You know, and I remember Barry and myself looking at each other and we're like, it looks exactly the same. You know, and then Barry comes out and says, we're the Ghost Investigators Society. We investigate ghosts. And to investigate ghosts, you have to question things. You can't take everything, well, it's, you know, we can't explain it right off, it's a ghost. Both Barry and I said, what kind of investigators would we be to just say, yeah, it looks the same, but it's still a ghost. We know for a fact it is. I mean, even though you just duplicate it with just two cameras, it's still a ghost.
Right.
I mean, it would have been the stupidest thing we could have done.
Right.
So I am glad that we left it on the website to at least show people this thing that looks like a ghost, and for the last 3-4 years we've all thought it was, and then it just took this thing to kind of go, well, wait a second.
But they haven't disproved that it wasn't a ghost, correct?
Well, there's no way you could prove either way. You couldn't prove that it was, you couldn't prove that it wasn't. But so the whole point is that with just two cameras and no digital effects or anything, they were able to make it look exactly the same. We know we had two or three cameras in there that night, and I mean, there's really nothing else you can say.
No.
So, like I said, it'll be interesting to see how they present all this on air.
Yeah. I'm glad we did it, because it was a good learning experience for us.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I think, if nothing else, it shows that we're not afraid to have people look at the stuff we do.
Exactly.
I mean, we don't have anything to hide by saying, you know what, if you can find a better, easier explanation for it, let us know, because that's what we're investigators.
Right.
We want to know if there is something
you
else.
You know, and I know that there's things that have happened. We've been with people where anything, even a sound that you can explain, they blame it on ghosts. Everything is ghosts. You've got to be more analytical than, I mean, you do want it to be a ghost, you know, but sometimes, I mean, you know yourself it isn't. And you can explain what it is, but they will not accept your explanation for what it was. To them, it's a ghost.
And I am glad you brought that up, because, I mean, we definitely have seen people like that. And to me, those, I mean, that gives the whole investigation thing, ghost investigations or ghost hunting, if you want to call things that, that gives it a bad name because you're not being analytical about it.
Right.
I mean, you don't need to go in there and be, well, nothing's a ghost and be skeptical about everything. But at the same time, you need to be. You need to question things, and you can't write off everything as, well, it was a ghost. That's, you know. All right, so is there an investigation that you can think of where, you know, the people inside the house are emotionally affected by what they think is going on or the haunting that is going on?
There was one where a man and woman had a daughter. I think she was probably around, the daughter was about 9 or 10. They all believed that there was a ghost in the house. The daughter was scared to death to be by herself. She would not go in the bathroom. She was scared to death of the bathroom for some reason. The mother had to stand in there while the child took a bath. The child wanted to sleep with them. She was scared to sleep in there in her own bed. Nice family. I didn't meet the daughter because I had told the lady that I didn't want the daughter there while we were conducting an investigation. And so they had the daughter gone during the period of time that we were there. But it was putting a strain on the man and woman's relationship because of the child sleeping with them all the time. They couldn't ever have the child there by herself because she was scared to death. Of course, she wouldn't want to leave a child that young by herself, but she wouldn't even stay in the house by herself if her mother was outside in the yard. So, you know, I think that they had gotten to a point of working themselves up almost into a frenzy.
Right, right.
Which was quite sad because there was nothing ever, you know, if there was something in the house, there was nothing ever threatening or harmful or displaying any kind of activity that would cause them to be concerned for their safety, you know. So that in that aspect, I felt very sorry for them.
So, I mean, you're saying it did emotionally affect the family. I mean,
they
whether
were affected, yes.
Whether there was a ghost there or not, them thinking there was, or at least their daughter thinking there was, that it did take a toll on the family.
Yes, it did. And that's a sad situation.
Yeah.
I don't think there was concern about having a ghost in the house as much as their physical relationship was being hampered by their daughter always with them.
But that's what I mean. I mean, the ghost is the cause of that. I mean, the ghost is causing the daughter to stay there, and the daughter staying there is causing the parents to have a strain on their relationship. It's all caused by the, you know, the one single thing, which is the haunting or the fact the daughter thinks there's a haunting. Now, something else I want to ask you about is there's a lot of talk about when people are passing away, or very close to passing away, they start to see their loved ones and things like that. Do you have any experience with that?
Well, you know, my dad has been dead for many years, but my mother had been seeing my dad, you know, last couple of years. She'd see him, and it could have been she was, you know, bad health and stuff, and she had been seeing my dad over the last few years of her life, and she had told, like, about the week before she passed away, she had told my sister that was caring for that dad was preparing her a place, getting things ready for her. And my sister woke my mom up that morning and tried to get her, you know, to eat something. She, you know, wasn't hungry. She wanted to go back to bed. And but when my sister was trying to get her up, my mother was pulling away. Darlene had a hold of her on one side, and she was pulling away like this on the other side, you know, and saying my dad's name, you know, and saying, "No, Reno, no." And Mom would never act that way with Dad. But she was pulling away from something, Darlene said, and you know, telling Dad no, you know, no. So I think he was there to get her that day, is how I feel, and he was trying to get her to come with him.
So, now, is that a pretty common thing that you've noticed? You know, people who are passing away, do they see loved ones right before they pass, or shortly before they pass?
We've had a lot of that experience in my family. But other people that I have talked with, where there's been a person in their family that has been ill for a length of time, they do start seeing dead loved ones. They talk to them. They have conversations with them. And I think that's quite a common phenomena. I know that there are a lot of researchers that feel speculate that that's a part of the human brain that displays that that occurrence, you know, that where they're seeing dead people around them and having conversations with them. But I'll bet I know of at least a dozen members of my family that when they were dying during that period of time, like within the last month, last year of their life, where they were getting frequent visitors that have passed away already that were there. And so I think that's a very common thing. And that's hard to say whether that's something in the human brain.
Right, right.
That causes that, or if they are experiencing seeing the spirit of a, you know, deceased loved one.
See,
or a friend.
And I have heard of, there's a guy named Matthew Alper. I don't know if you've heard of him or not. He wrote a book called The God Part of the Brain.
Right.
And he talks a lot about that stuff.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, it seems like I've heard a lot of, I haven't read the book, but I have heard a lot of interviews with him. And it seems like he can answer certain things, but then there's other parts that he just, you know, I mean, even his studies don't really answer it.
Well, Brendan, as you know, I'm going through what Barbara's already gone through with my mother right now.
Exactly.
And, of course, I'm not saying this to make anybody sad, but it's interesting. As you know, and other members know, I'm nothing special, but I'm a little sensitive. And it's odd. I'm in the hospital room, and there's my mother looking like death itself. I felt my dad's presence.
Really? Well, and, you know, I do think there are quite a few people that have that ability where they can, you know, sense things that are around. And I know, I always tell you, I can't sense anything. I mean,
you and me are pretty much the same.
Yeah,
we're
pretty much the same. I mean, I could walk into a completely haunted room, and unless something physically happens, you know,
you have had happen.
Yes, I have had happen. But unless that happens, I have no idea. There's, you know, I can't walk into a room and go, I feel somebody staring at me.
So. But she also, for the last 3 or 4 years, she saw a little girl around the house. My mother did.
Really?
She kept asking my sister, who was that little girl? And my sister had no little children there. There was no little girl in the house, but she was always concerned about this little girl. And my two sisters speculated that it could have been our sister that my mother and dad lost before any of us were born. So, you know, they think that it was her that was there at the house.
So now, your mom actually said that she saw a little girl around the house?
Yes. She was always asking Darlene, where's that little girl?
So your mom thought it was real. I mean, your
right.
mom actually thought this girl was in the house.
Right.
Okay.
But, you know, it's hard to say. It could have been part of her mind, you know, that was seeing things, because she was doing some odd things that her thought processes weren't right. So, you know, you got to
wonder what's going on.
Yeah.
But didn't she say to you and some of the other family members that why are so many people in the house? Wouldn't you be alone?
Yes. Well, she said people were going in and out of that house all the time.
Really? You know, and that's weird. There's an article on it's on ghostpicks.com also, but I believe it was first in the LA Times. It was called something like, why do so many people see the train?
The train.
Or something about the train. And it was basically all about these people who were so close to death, and they have this sensation right before they pass on of traveling. Something about, you know, they'll say something about bags or something about, you know, they've got to get their stuff ready to go or they're going to miss the train, things like that. And also a lot of them start talking about something like a train station or some kind
yeah.
of, you know, like an airport. And it's odd because you mentioned that your mom was saying, well, why are there so many people in the house? Could she have been kind of seeing that same thing? That
it kind of makes me wonder when people are in the process of dying, when the body starts to, whether it's through an illness or a just old age and the body's worn out and starting to, you know, fade. It kind of makes me wonder, it almost makes me think, it's a kind of a theory I've been working on ever since, it was before me and Roger got married. I had a cousin that died of cancer when she was 16. She was constantly carrying on conversations. It wasn't a brain tumor or anything, you know, that she had that would affect her thinking that way. She was carrying on conversations with friends of hers that had passed away and dead relatives that she didn't even know, but she would name them. She didn't
really
even know of them. And she was aware of these people. This Uncle Willie that I can barely remember him. When I was little, was the last time I saw him before he died. And I don't think this cousin of mine even knew of him. But he was there talking with her. And it almost makes me wonder if people are in both worlds at the same time.
Right. Now, so she was talking about this uncle that she had never met?
Yes, and she wouldn't have even known of him.
And she just said Uncle Willie, or she had... Now, see, this all goes back to earlier we were talking about EVP, and you mentioned contemporary information. That right there is contemporary information.
That's right.
So you go into, you know, like we talked about Matthew Alper and writing this book, The God Part of the Brain. Well, that's great, but how do you explain this contemporary information of this girl talking about somebody she's never met, but it's somebody that actually existed and is part of your family?
Right. And she mentioned several people. Some of them I had never met. They had passed away before I was born. She had mentioned names of those people that were there visiting her, that she is very doubtful if she ever had heard about these people. And one interesting thing is my older sister had gone into the hospital room to visit with her, and she called my sister that was visiting her the name of the dead sister.
Really?
And my sister Darlene says, honey, I'm not Margie Gale, I'm Darlene. And she says, oh, you look just like her, which I thought was kind of an interesting thing.
Well, yeah, that's, I mean.
So I do feel like they're kind of in both worlds sometimes when there's death coming.
Yeah, yeah.
Brendan, do you believe that death is a person?
Do I believe that death is a person, like, well,
like
in the Grim Reaper, death?
Or like,
death,
Holy,
like
Ghost,
the Holy Ghost.
And, he's an individual.
You know, I mean, do you believe that death is a personification of, you know what I'm saying? Like,
well,
it's
no,
a person?
I know what you're saying.
During,
I mean, you're talking about the cliched Grim Reaper kind of thing where somebody comes, gets you, and in a way, I guess I do and I don't. You know, I guess I do because it has been talked about for even not just the Christian religion, but I mean, so many religions, people talk about this thing that comes and gets them and takes them to the other side or however it works. So I guess in that way I do, but at the same time, you know, how do I really know? I mean,
yeah, this is just my theory, if you will, but when you were talking earlier to Barbara about how people feel like they have to pack the bags, they're going on a trip, I sometimes wonder if that's a physical reaction to a spiritual feeling of knowing you're leaving, going somewhere.
Well, yeah.
Do you believe in ghosts, Brendan?
Do I believe in ghosts, Barbara?
Spirits?
Yes, I do. I believe in them. I think I've seen enough and experienced enough interesting, we'll use that word, interesting things, that no matter what I do, I can't figure them out. And
you know what I like the best that I witnessed?
No. I don't even want to hear about it.
I know it really, really bothers you, but that was probably one of the neatest things to witness.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't want to have it happen to me.
Oh, of course not, but it's okay when it happens to Brendan. Nobody cares.
Yeah, that's okay.
Uh-huh.
But the one thing I regret about that is not keeping that.
You're sick. You are sick, Barbara. Why?
I mean, if people would have saw that gob of hair that materialized in your mouth. I mean, it just looked old.
You are so heartless.
I mean, you could just see it being cut off somebody's
Barbara,
you know, dead body.
Explain.
The old corpse, you know, laying there.
Barbara, we can all visualize. All you had to say was, look, you had a gob of old hair in your mouth that you spit out.
It came, you know, just developed there in your mouth. Your mouth produced this hair unbelievably well.
Brain is going.
Oh, yeah, I was choking.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a gob of
hair.
Yeah, but, and you know, that's fine. Well, no, I'm not even going to say that's fine. I'm going to say, okay, great, that happened. But then you have to go and say, well, you picture the dead corpse that it came off of. Thanks a lot, Barbara. I could have done that without you telling me.
I mean, that's what it reminded me of. It was old, old hair.
Yeah, that just suddenly appeared in my mouth. Thanks.
Remember all the hair that was in that big old Bible on the table?
That was a lock of hair. That was curled.
That was
curled hair. That wasn't a gob of unruly old hair.
So yes, that is one of my many unexplainable experiences of okay. So yes, I do believe in ghosts because I have had a number of experiences like that.
Uh-huh.
Roger,
that was so
just completely disgusting, but it was quite an interesting adventure.
It was. So I mean, I've had enough of those things happen that yes, I do believe in them. I don't need any more. I mean, I don't need more hair stuck in my mouth, like blowing.
In that Pioneer Cemetery, you were slapped.
Yeah, I don't need to be slapped. I don't need to see little boys run behind me. I don't need things like this. I know they exist.
And that phone that vibrates off the table?
See, in the phone thing, I could chalk that up to an earthquake. I could try. I could say, well, you know what? I didn't feel it, but we live in Utah, so it's a fault line. I can do that, but seeing a boy run behind me, no. What earthquake's going to cause that? Hair in my mouth. Don't know unless I put it there. Okay. I mean, things like that, I can't explain them. Oh, God. And what's sad is those are the kinds of things that make you believe in this. Those are the kinds of things that you look at and go...
They're almost a nonsensical type of thing.
Almost a nonsensical thing,
you
Barbara.
You know, I mean, because now, like, this niece that my brother's daughter, she was a stewardess for Southwest Airlines, and they would stop at, you know, on layovers at certain hotels in certain cities. Well, this hotel happened to be in Texas, some part of Texas.
El Paso.
And she had gotten in late from her flight, and they shared rooms, you know, the staff did. And she had gotten in quite late, so she was trying to be quiet so she didn't wake up the other young lady that was sharing the room. And Natalie had put all of her pocket change on this little nightstand by the bed. Well, during the night, she had to get up and use the bathroom. And she felt something, she said at first she thought it was an ice cube under her armpit. And she reached up underneath there, and it was a dime. And she said it was so cold. And she doesn't know how much change she had set out on her nightstand. She says she doesn't know if it was one of her, one of her coins that she had set out. She says, I guess I could have done that in my sleep. But She said, I just can't imagine it. But the thing that she couldn't get over was that it was cold, so cold. The coin was so cold itself, and it, she said it was just like somebody had taken it out of a freezer.
And see, and I'm that way. I'm the kind of person that something like that happens, and I guess I could have grabbed some chunk of hair and put it in my mouth.
Well, but we would have seen you do that.
Oh, I'm sure you would have.
Well, but we were just right there with you.
I mean, I do the exact same thing. I try and rationalize, you know, what could have happened? What, you know, is there something else that could have caused this?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I guess it all goes back to what we were saying. You have to do that. To be legitimate and to be serious about it and to actually experience real things, you have to sit there and go, well, that could be
analyze it from
exactly.
All different directions.
So that's all great. You've asked me your question about if I believe in ghosts and given me some pretty horrible reasons on why. So how about this?
What?
What's next for the GIS? What's on the agenda?
Well, there's a couple of things that we could mention here.
Please do.
A gentleman got in contact with Barry. He emailed Barry wanting to know if we would be interested in doing a few workshops for the National Property Management Association.
Ooh.
I guess it's a national group.
I would
going by
so
the name. And
what would that be? The NPMA or something? Is that what their acronym is?
I don't know. They have a lot of members that manage properties with buildings on them, and their tenants that are in some of these buildings are complaining about ghost activity, and these property managers. Don't know what advice to give their tenants. They don't know what to do about it. And so they have asked us to do a couple of workshops to try to help these property managers how to deal with the tenants and the situation. I'm personally hoping that this really leads to some really good investigations that we get asked to do. But if not, it will be an interesting experience anyway. I always like doing that. We've been asked to do several things like that, and I always enjoy it.
To me, that is just amazing, just who that is, because that is showing there's a legitimate issue, that these people are experiencing something, and these realtors don't have the answer for it. So, you know, they're asking
for
us,
help.
I guess, to come in and give them advice on what to tell these people, which is showing, like I said, that
it's a problem out there that most people don't want to talk about. They don't know even how to approach it, and they don't know where to go for answers.
Well, and that's what I'm saying. I mean, it's showing this is a legitimate issue.
Yes.
I mean, this is something that is happening.
That's
and
right.
To me, it's almost along the lines of, you know, in New York, you had the court ruling that a realtor has to disclose if the house has been reported haunted.
Property owners have got to disclose that information.
And to me, I mean, this is right along the lines of that, because it's just so amazing that these people are having to deal with this also. So you've left your, I don't want to say your crackpot, but, you know, you've left your people that...
These are professionals.
Exactly. I mean,
and
these are...
You know, they've got to believe their tenants.
Well, yeah. I mean, otherwise they're not going to have tenants anymore.
So that, you know, there is something going on, and hopefully we can guide them on how to approach things and how to deal with the tenants that are in these properties. But another thing that'll be coming up on April 15th.
Oh, tax day!
Besides the tax man, which is really about the scariest thing on earth.
Yeah, I don't think anything that we could do
would even be comparing to the IRS. But we have an art bell coming up on Saturday night on the April 15th, and so you know, we always look forward to that.
Oh, Bell's a good guy.
Oh, yes.
I love Bell. I'm glad you brought that up, because I've got this voice that I've been toying around on playing it on this show, because we are going to use it on the Coast to Coast show. I figure people might enjoy hearing it before we do that show. You know, and this is one of the many that we'll play on that show. And this was recorded in the Exchange Building, which, you know, many people listening to this are going to be familiar with. In this clip, you're going to hear me saying, this is our second recording, we're just getting ready to leave. And I've actually set this laptop up in the room where we recorded the water clip. And we basically just left it there all night. I, you know, went back to it every 20 minutes to a half an hour to reset the file, but, I mean, it just sat there all night. And this was recorded right as I'm resetting the file to the second recording. Okay, so in this clip, you're going to hear me saying, okay, now this is our second recording, we're just now getting ready to leave. And directly after me, it sounds like, and I was the only one in the room at this time, I'm only talking because I'm letting the recorder know what's going on, which, I mean, is something we do every time we go out anyway. And at the end of it, you hear, it sounds like a woman saying, he's dead. It really doesn't sound like it has anything to do with what I'm saying, but, you know, if you put it in context with the boy drowning in that room, or if the boy did drown in that room, whatever the case was, I mean, that's the room where that was recorded. If you put it in context with that, I mean, it makes you wonder if that's who she's referring to.
Okay, this is our second recording from the event. We are now getting ready to leave. Okay, this is our second recording from the event. We are now getting ready to leave.
Alright, so playing that file, I mean, what do you think? I mean, how does it sound to you?
Sounds very good. It has the quality of EVP that we've become so familiar with. And it kind of makes you wonder what she's referring to. If she's referring to the little boy that was in the water.
Well, you know, I'd like to express that, you know, after listening to so many voices, you almost can tell when... And individually speaking, you can almost difference between a real voice and a ghost voice.
So you listened to it, you thought it sounded good.
It's a good voice, it's a good EVP.
That's for you out there listening, that's one of the many you can expect from the Art Bell Show on the 15th. Hopefully it'll kind of tease you into listening there. I can see Barbara over there yawning. It's I think it's past her bedtime.
Past my bedtime.
Okay. So that's it. That's the end of this show. And I definitely want to thank you guys for coming over here. It's not like it's a huge change from anything that we really do, but
no, but it was different.
Well, no, it's fun to sit here and talk. I mean, it is, and hopefully...
The only thing that's missing is my dining room table, Brendan.
Yeah, it is a little bit weird doing it in here as opposed to in your kitchen at the dining room table.
Yeah.
And formulating the plot to take over the world.
Exactly.
Or whatever it is that we do all the time.
Taking over the plat.
The plat. Yeah, take over the plat. So, I do thank you guys for doing this. We're definitely going to keep doing it because this is just fun to do, and I think... Yeah, I think a lot of people are going to like it. I think they're going to listen to it and realize how much fun we have.
Well, I want to personally wish you a lot of luck on this. I hope it's something that grows and...
We'll see where it goes. I mean, you guys...
Hopefully it'll be successful.
Well, you guys are going to be a big part of it, so wherever I go, you guys go. So
thank you.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah,
thank you.
Will.
Thank you, listeners. Good night.
And that is it. That was... Barbara and Roger Macbeth, and this is the end of our show for tonight. We do thank everybody for listening, and we will be back next week. Good night, everybody, and take care.
Armageddon!